sick about it. I'm worried out of my mind about Brooke. But it isn't true. At all. So I wanted you to know that too. I finally meet his eyes full on. They're sad and scared and, yes, kind. In that moment, I choose to believe he's not a Kelly boy with a temper, or someone with opportunity and motive, or the quiet kind you'd never suspect. I choose to believe he's the person he's always shown himself to be. I choose to trust him. "We believe you," I say. And he sags, visibly with relief.
Chapter 20. Malcolm. Monday, September 30th. Brooke is still missing at lunchtime, and I'm getting a first-hand look at what my brother went through 5 years ago. The entire Echo Ridge High student body has been staring at me all morning. Everybody's whispering behind my back, except the few who get right in my face. Like Kyle McNulty. He and his sister Liz were away all weekend visiting her friends at the University of Vermont, so nobody's interrogating him. Almost as soon as I walked into the hallway this morning, he grabbed my arm and slammed me against the locker bay. "If you did anything to Brooke, I will end you," he growled. I broke away and shoved him back. "Fuck you, McNulty." He probably would have hit me then if a teacher hadn't stepped between us. Now Mia and I are headed for the cafeteria, passing a homecoming poster along the way. During morning announcements, Principal Slate said that while they hadn't decided whether to cancel Saturday's dance, it was being significantly scaled back, with no homecoming court. He ended with a reminder to report anything or anyone suspicious, which, for most of the student body, is me. If I weren't so sick to my stomach, I might laugh at how fiercely Mia glares at everyone we pass in the hallway. "Go ahead and try it," she mutters as a couple of Kyle's teammates, who are twice her size, give me the once-over. "I hope you do." In the cafeteria, we grab trays. I pile food on mine that I know I won't be able to eat, and then we make our way to our usual table. By unspoken agreement, we both sit with our backs against the wall, facing the cafeteria. If anybody's coming for me, I'd rather see them do it. Mia sends a look of pure loathing toward Katrin's table, where Viv is gesturing dramatically. "Already working on her next story, I'll bet. This is exactly the plot twist she was waiting for." I force down a sip of water. "Jesus, Mia, they're friends." "Stop thinking the best of people, Mal," Mia says. "Nobody's doing it for you. We should..." She trails off as the noise level in the cafeteria grows louder. The Corcoran twins have emerged from the food line, trays in hand. I haven't talked to them yet today, and every time I've spotted one of them, they were surrounded by knots of students. The whole school knows they were the second-to-last people to see Brooke before she disappeared, and everybody wants their take on Saturday night. I don't have to be within earshot to know what kind of questions they're getting. "Have you guys heard that Brooke and Malcolm were hooking up? Did they act weird around each other? Were they fighting? Do you think he did something to her?" I could tell yesterday that Ezra is exactly like Mia. It never even occurred to him that I might have done anything except drop Brooke off. Ellery's mind doesn't work that way, though. She's naturally suspicious. I get it, but it stung. And even though it seemed like she came around eventually, I'm not sure it's going to last when half the school is whispering in her ear. Mia watches the two of them like she's having the exact same thought. Ezra's eyes light on us at almost the same time Katrin's hand shoots into the air. "Ellery!" Katrin calls. "Over here!" She doesn't include Ezra, and I feel pathetically grateful when he starts toward us, even though I know it's probably just because he wasn't invited anywhere else. Ellery hesitates, and it feels as though the entire cafeteria is watching her. Her curly hair is long and loose today, and when she looks toward Katrin, it obscures half her face. My heart jackhammers in my chest as I try to tell myself it doesn't matter what she does, it won't change anything. Brooke will still be missing, and half the town will still hate me because I'm a Kelly. Ellery lifts her hand and waves at Katrin, then turns away from her and follows Ezra to our table. I exhale for what feels like the first time all day, relieved, but the buzz in the cafeteria only gets louder. Ezra reaches us first, pulling out two chairs with a noisy scrape and lowering himself into one of them. "Hey," he says quietly. Ellery puts her tray next to his and slips into the remaining chair, offering me a tentative smile. Just like that, we're all outsiders together. "It's not right. It's not okay." That's the part of what Brooke said in the Fright Farm office that sticks with me the most. With Ellery, too. "The one time I sat with her and Katrin at lunch, she looked worn down," she says. "Something was definitely bothering her." We're at Mia's house after school, scattered around her living room. I'm keeping a constant eye on social media, hoping for some kind of positive update on Brooke, but all I see are posts about organizing a search. The police don't want people doing anything on their own, so they're recruiting volunteers for a coordinated effort. Daisy is holed up in her bedroom as usual, and Mia's parents aren't home. Thank God. I'd like to think Dr. and Mr. Kwan wouldn't treat me any different from how they always have, but I'm not ready to find out. "Maybe that's why she was talking to Vance," Mia says. She's still seething that nobody took me seriously about that. "She could have been asking for help." Ezra looks dubious. "I don't know. I've only met the guy once, but he didn't strike me as the helpful type." "He was Sadie's homecoming date," Ellery says. "That means nothing, I guess, but it's weird how he keeps popping up, isn't it?" "Yeah, I agree. But he was locked up all night." "According to Officer McNulty," Ellery says darkly. I blink at her. "What, you think he was making that up?" At least she's equal opportunity with her conspiracy theories. "I don't think the Echo Ridge police are very competent, do you?" she asks. "Somebody basically drew them a map that was all, 'Hey, hello, here's my next victim,' and she disappeared anyway." She half swallows the last word, hunching down in the Kwan's oversized leather armchair. I blink, surprised at how lost she suddenly looks, and then I could kick myself for being so caught up in my own problems that I didn't make the connection sooner. "You're scared," I say, "because of course she is. She was on that list too." Ezra leans forward on the couch. "Nothing's going to happen to you, Elle," he says, like he can make it true through sheer force of will. Mia nods vigorously beside him. "I know." Ellery hugs her knees to her chest and rests her chin on them. "That's not how this works, right? It's always one girl. There's no reason to worry about me right now or Katrin. Just Brooke." There's no way in hell I'm going to remind her that we don't have a clue how any of this works. "We can worry about all of you. But it'll be all right, Ellery. We'll make sure of it." It's the worst reassurance ever, coming from the guy who thought he got Brooke home safely. But it's all I've got. Light footsteps sound on the stairs, and Daisy appears on the landing. She's wearing giant sunglasses and an oversized sweater, clutching her bag like a shield. "I'm going out for a little while," she says, heading for the Kwan's front door and pulling a jacket off their coat rack. She moves so quickly, she looks as though she's gliding across the floor. "Kay," Mia says, scrolling through her phone like she's barely listening. But as soon as the door closes behind Daisy, Mia's head snaps up.
"Let's follow her,"
she says in a loud whisper, springing to her feet. Ezra and Ellery lift their brows in almost comical unison. "We already know where she goes," I object, my face getting hot as the twins exchange surprised glances. "Great. Nothing like outing yourself as a stalker in front of your only friends." "But we don't know why," Mia says, peering through the blinds of the window next to the door. "Daisy's seeing a psychologist and she never told me," she adds over her shoulder to the twins. "It's all very mysterious, and I, for one, am sick of mysteries around here. At least we can do something about this one if we're quick enough." "Okay, she just pulled out. Let's go." "Mia, this is ridiculous," I protest. But to my surprise, Ellery's already halfway to the door, with Ezra right behind her. Neither of them seems concerned about the fact that Mia's spying on her own sister with my help. So we pile into my mother's Volvo and head down the same road Daisy took last Thursday. We catch up to her pretty quickly and keep a few car lengths behind her. "Don't lose her," Mia says, her eyes on the road. "We need answers."
"What are you going to do? Try to listen in on her session?"
Ezra sounds both confused and disturbed. I'm with him. Even if that wasn't a massive violation of Daisy's privacy and probably illegal, I don't see how you could do it.
"I don't know,"
Mia says with a shrug. Typical Mia. All action, no planning.
"She's going twice in 1 week. That seems like a lot, doesn't it?"
"Beats me," I say, getting into the left lane in preparation for a turn that Daisy will be making at the next intersection. Except she doesn't. I swerve to stay straight, and the car behind me blares its horn as I run a yellow light.
"Smooth," Ezra notes. "This is going well. Very stealthy."
Mia frowns.
"Now where's she going?"
"Jim," I guess, starting to feel foolish. "Shopping?" But Daisy doesn't head downtown or toward the highway that would take us to the nearest mall. She sticks to back roads until we pass Bukowski's Tavern and enter Salisbury, the next town over. The houses are smaller and closer together here than they are in Echo Ridge, and the lawns look like they get mowed a lot less. Daisy's blinker comes on after we pass a liquor store, and she turns in front of a sign that reads Pine Crest Estates. That's an optimistic name, I think. It's an apartment complex, full of the kind of cheap, boxy places you can't find in Echo Ridge, but that are all over Salisbury. Mom and I checked out someplace similar right before she and Peter got together. If they hadn't, we weren't going to be able to hang on to our house for much longer. Even if it was the smallest, crappiest house in all of Echo Ridge.
"Is she moving out?"
Mia wonders. Daisy inches through the parking lot, angling the gray Nissan in front of number 9. There's a blue car to her right, and I pull into an empty spot next to that. We all scrunch down in our seats as she gets out of the car, like that'll keep us incognito. All Daisy would have to do is turn her head to catch sight of my mother's Volvo. But she doesn't look around as she gets out, just strides forward and knocks on the door. Once, twice, and then a third time. Daisy pulls off her sunglasses, stuffs them into her bag, and knocks again.
"Maybe we should leave before she gives up. I don't think they're
I stop talking when the door to number 9 opens. Somebody wraps his arms around Daisy and swings her halfway around, kissing her so deeply that Mia lets out a gasp beside me.
"Oh my God, Daisy has a boyfriend,"
she says, scrambling out of her seatbelt and leaning so far left that she's practically in my lap.
and here she's been so mopey McMoperson since she moved home. I did not see that coming.
We're all craning our necks for a better view, but it's not until Daisy breaks away that I catch sight of who she's with, along with something I haven't seen in years. My brother, grinning like his face is about to break, before he pulls Daisy inside and shuts the door behind her.
Chapter 21. Ellery. Monday, September 30th. "So," Malcolm says, plugging tokens into one end of a foosball table.
"That was interesting."
After leaving Declan's apartment, we stopped at the first place we came to that we were pretty sure he and Daisy wouldn't show up on a date. It happened to be a Chuck E. Cheese's. I haven't been to one in years, so I've forgotten what a sensory assault they are. Flashing lights, beeping games, tinny music, and screaming children. The guy letting people in at the door wasn't sure about us at first.
"You're supposed to come with kids," he said,
glancing behind us at the empty hallway. "We are kids," Mia pointed out, extending her hand for a stamp.
"Turns out, Chuck E. Cheese's is the perfect location for a clandestine debrief. Every adult in the place is too busy either chasing after or hiding from their children to pay us any attention. I feel weirdly calm after our trip to Pinecrest Estates. The dread that came over me at Mia's house almost entirely gone. There's something satisfying about unlocking another piece of the Echo Ridge puzzle, even if I'm not sure yet where it fits.
So," Mia echoes, gripping a handle on the other end of the foosball table. Ezra is next to her, and I'm beside Malcolm. A ball pops out of one side, and Mia spins a bar furiously, missing the ball completely.
"Your brother and my sister. How long do you think that's been going on?"
Malcolm maneuvers one of his players carefully before smacking the ball, and would have scored if Ezra hadn't blocked it.
"Damned if I know. Since they both came back, maybe? But that still doesn't explain what they're doing here. Couldn't they hook up in New Hampshire or Boston?"
He passes the ball to one of his own men, then backward to me, and I rocket a shot across the field into the open goal. Malcolm gives me a surprised, disarmed grin that dissolves the tense set of his jaw.
"Not bad."
I want to smile back, but I can't. There's something I've been thinking ever since we pulled away from Pinecrest Estates, and I keep weighing how, or whether, to bring it up.
"I don't think they can hook up anywhere," Mia says. "Can you imagine if one of the reporters who've been prowling around Echo Ridge got wind of this? Lacey Kilduff's boyfriend and best friend, together 5 years later? While somebody's making a mockery of her death by writing bullshit all around town and another girl's just gone missing?"
She shudders, managing to nick the ball with the edge of one of her men.
"People would hate them."
"What if it's not 5 years later?" The words pop out of me, and Malcolm goes still. The foosball rolls unchallenged down the length of the table and settles into a corner.
"I mean," I add, almost apologetically, "they might have been together for a while."
Mia shakes her head. "Daisy's had other boyfriends. She almost got engaged to the guy she was dating at Princeton."
"Okay, so not all 5 years," I say. "But maybe at some point in high school?"
Malcolm's jaw has gone tense again. He braces his forearms on the table and fastens his green eyes on me. Both are disconcerting at close range, if I'm being honest.
"Like when?"
"Like while Declan was still dating Lacey. It'd be the classic deadly love triangle. I have to bite the inside of my cheeks to keep from saying it out loud. What if Declan and Daisy fell in love years ago and wanted to be together,
but Lacey wouldn't let him go, or threatened to do something to Daisy in retaliation. And it infuriated Declan so much that he lost control one night and killed her. Then Daisy broke things off with him, obviously, and tried to forget him, but couldn't. I'm itching to expand on my theory, but one look at Malcolm's frozen face tells me I shouldn't. I don't know, I hedge, dropping my eyes. Just throwing out ideas. It's like I told Ezra in the library. You can't spring a "your siblings might be murderers" theory onto people all at once. Mia doesn't notice the subtext of my back and forth with Malcolm. She's too busy savagely jerking her rod of blue players without ever touching the ball. It wouldn't be an issue if Daisy would just talk to me, or to anyone in our family.
Maybe you need to pull a little sister power play, Ezra suggests.
Such as? He shrugs.
She tells you what's going on, or you tell your parents what you just saw.
Mia goggles at him.
That's straight up evil. But effective, I'll bet, Ezra says.
He glances at Malcolm.
I'd suggest the same thing to you, but I just saw your brother, so.
Oh yeah, Malcolm grimaces. He'd kill me. Not literally, he adds hastily, with a sideways glance at me. But also, he knows I'd never do it. Our father wouldn't care, but our mom would lose it, especially now. Mia's eyes gleam as she lines one of her men up for a shot.
I have no such concerns.
We play for a few minutes without speaking. My mind keeps racing along the Declan-Daisy theory that I didn't say, testing it for holes. There are a few, admittedly, but it's such a true crime staple when girls go missing or are harmed. It's always the boyfriend. Or a frustrated wannabe. Because when you're 17 and beautiful, and you're found murdered in a place known for hookups, what could it possibly be except a crime of passion? So that leaves Declan. The only other person I'm even remotely suspicious of is the guy Lacey never noticed. Officer Ryan Rodriguez. I can't forget his photo in the yearbook, or Sadie's description of him breaking down at Lacey's funeral. Still, Officer Rodriguez doesn't fit like Declan does. He makes perfect sense, especially now that we know about him and Daisy. I don't believe for one second that they're a new thing. The only question in my mind is whether Malcolm's willing to admit it. I steal a glance at Malcolm as he twists his handles, fully concentrating on the game. Brow furrowed, green eyes crinkling when he makes a good shot, lean arms flexing. He has absolutely no idea how attractive he is, and it's kind of a problem. He's so used to living in his brother's shadow that he doesn't believe he's the kind of guy who could have snagged the attention of a girl like Brooke. Anybody else can see it from a mile away. He looks up and meets my eyes. Busted. I feel myself go red as his mouth lifts in a half smile. Then he glances down again, pulling his phone from his pocket and unlocking the screen. His face changes in an instant. Mia sees it too and stops spinning her handles. Any news? She asks.
A text from my mom. Nothing about Brooke, Malcolm says. And we all relax, because from the look on his face, it wouldn't have been good. Except there's a search party tomorrow, during the day, so Echo Ridge students aren't supposed to go. And there's an article in the Boston Globe. He sighs heavily. My mom's freaking out. She gets traumatized any time the news mentions Lacey.
Can I see? I ask. He hands the phone to me, and I read the section framed within the screen.
The small town was already on edge after a series of vandalism incidents beginning in early September. Buildings and signs were defaced with messages written as though they were from Lacey Kilduff's killer. The anonymous threats promised another attack on one of the girls elected to homecoming court. A short list that included Brooke Bennett. But those who've been following the story closely don't see any real connection. Even if someone was unhinged enough to get away with murder and brag about it 5 years later, the MOs are completely different, says Vivian Cantrell, a senior at Echo Ridge High, who has covered the story for her school paper. Strangulation is a brutal crime of passion. The threats are public, and they require planning. I don't think there's any relation at all to what happened to Lacey, or what's going on with Brooke. I grip the phone more tightly. That's almost exactly what I said 2 weeks ago at lunch. Viv basically stole my entire spiel and used it to replace her original point of view. Before this, she'd been telling everybody that Lacey's death and the anonymous threats had to be related. Why did Viv suddenly change her tune? Chapter 22. Ellery. Wednesday, October 2nd. It's the first week in October, and starting to get dark earlier. But even if it weren't, Nana would insist on driving Ezra and me to our shift at Fright Farm after dinner. I don't bother reminding her that it's only a 10-minute walk as she plucks her keys from a hook next to her wall-mounted phone. Brooke has been missing for 4 days, and the entire town is on edge. Search parties all day and candlelight vigils at night. After 2 days of heated debate at school, homecoming is still on for Saturday, but without a court. I'm no longer technically a princess, which is fine, I guess, since I still don't have a date. The same few theories keep circulating, that Brooke ran away, that she's the victim of the Murderland killer, that one of the Kelly boys did something to her. Everything in Echo Ridge feels like a thick, bubbling mess that's about to boil over. Nana is silent on the ride over, clutching the steering wheel and driving 15 miles below the speed limit until we near the entrance. Then she pulls to the side of the road and says, "The House of Horrors closes at 11, right?" "Right. I'll be outside the gates at 11:05. That's 2 hours past her bedtime, but we don't argue. I told her earlier that Malcolm could give us a ride, and she insisted on picking us up anyway. I don't think she believes he's involved in Brooke's disappearance. She hasn't told us to stop hanging out with him, but she's not taking any chances, and I can't blame her. I'm a little surprised she's still letting us go to work. Ezra and I climb out of the car and watch its taillights recede so slowly that a bicycle passes it. We're halfway through the gates when my phone rings with a familiar California number. I hold it up to Ezra. Sadie must have heard. It was only a matter of time. Brooke's disappearance has become national news, and Nana's been hanging up all week on reporters angling for a one-town, three-missing-girls story. Hamilton House Rehabilitation Facility allegedly bans internet access, but since Sadie's already used her borrowed cell phone to check out Ezra's Instagram before FaceTiming us, she's obviously flouting that rule, too. I slide to answer and press the phone to my ear. "Hi, Sadie." "Ellery, thank God you picked up." Her agitated voice crackles across the line. "I just read about what's happening there. Are you and Ezra all right?" "We're fine. Just worried about Brooke." "Oh my God, of course you are. That poor girl, her poor family." She pauses for a beat, her breath harsh in my ear. "So,
the article. It said there were threats beforehand toward three girls and that one of them was someone who was related to... Was it you, Ellery?
It was me, I confirm. Ezra gestures like he wants me to FaceTime, but I wave him off. It's too crowded here.
Why didn't you tell me?
The bitter laugh springs out of me without warning.
Why would I?
Silence on the other end, so complete that I think she's disconnected. I'm about to pull the phone away from my ear to check when Sadie says,
Because I'm your mother and I have a right to know.
It's exactly the wrong thing to say. Resentment floods my veins, and I have to grip the phone extra tight to stop myself from hurling it to the ground.
Oh, really? You have a right to know? That's rich coming from somebody who's never told us anything that matters.
What are you talking about?
Our father? We're not allowed to ask questions about him. Our grandmother? We barely knew her until we had to live with her. Our aunt? You had a twin sister as close as me and Ezra are, and you never, ever talk about her. Now we're stuck here watching the same horrible story unfold again, and everybody's talking about the first girl who went missing, except us. We don't know anything about Sarah because you won't even say her name.
I'm breathing hard, my heart pounding as I stalk through the park. I don't know whether I'm relieved or horrified to finally be saying these things to Sadie. All I know is that I can't stop.
You're not okay, Sadie. I mean, you get that, right? You're not in rehab because of some freak accident that'll be a funny story to tell at parties when you get out. You weren't taking those pills to relax. I've spent years waiting for something like this to happen, and I thought... I was afraid.
Tears blur my vision and slide down my face.
This whole year, I've been expecting that phone call. The one Nana got and Melanie got. The one that says, you're never coming home.
She's been silent during my entire tirade. But this time, before I can check to see whether she's hung up on me, I hear a choked sob.
I can't,
Sadie says in a ragged voice that I'd never recognize if I didn't know it was her.
I can't talk about her. It kills me.
I've wandered near the games section, and I have to plug my free ear against the noise of the park. Ezra stands a short distance away, his arms folded and his face grave.
It's killing you not to, I say.
She doesn't answer, and I squeeze my eyelids shut. I can't look at my brother right now.
Sadie, I know, okay? I know exactly how you must feel. Me and Ezra both do. It's horrible what happened to Sarah. It sucks, and it's not fair, and I'm so, so sorry for you and for Nana and for her.
My mother's sobs on the other end of the line pierce me like a knife to the heart.
And I'm sorry I yelled at you. I didn't mean to. It's just, I feel like we're going to be stuck like this forever if we can't talk about it.
I open my eyes while I wait for her to answer. It's almost dark now, and the park lights glow against the deep blue sky. Screams and catcalls fill the air, and little kids chase one another with their parents a safe distance behind. All of Fright Farm's success is based on how much people love to be scared in a controlled environment. There's something deeply, fundamentally satisfying about confronting a monster and escaping unscathed. Real monsters aren't anything like that. They don't let go.
Do you know what I was doing the night Sarah disappeared?
Sadie asks in the same hoarse voice. My reply is barely a whisper. No. Losing my virginity to my homecoming date. She lets out a hysterical half-laugh, half-sob. I was supposed to be with Sarah, but I blew her off. For that. Oh, Sadie. I don't even realize I've sunk to the ground until my free hand touches grass. It's not your fault. Of course it's my fault. If I'd been with her, she'd still be here. You don't know that. You can't. You were just living your life. Being normal. You didn't do anything wrong. None of this is your fault. Would you feel that way? If something happened to Ezra when you were supposed to be with him? I don't answer right away, and she cries harder. I can't look at my mother. I couldn't look at my father. I didn't speak to him for almost a year before he died, and then I drank my way through the entire funeral. You and your brother are the only thing I've ever done right since Sarah disappeared. And now I've ruined that, too. You didn't ruin anything. I say it automatically to comfort her, but as soon as the words are out of my mouth, I realize they're true. Ezra and I might not have had the most stable childhood, but we never had any doubt that our mother loved us. She never put a job or a boyfriend ahead of us, and it wasn't until the pills took hold that her haphazard parenting turned into actual neglect. Sadie's made mistakes, but they're not the kind that leave you feeling like you don't matter. We're fine, and we love you, and please don't do this to yourself. Don't blame yourself for something so awful that you never could have seen coming. I'm babbling now, my words tripping over themselves, and Sadie lets out a teary laugh. Listen to us. You wanted to talk, huh? Be careful what you wish for. There's so much I want to say, but all I can manage is, I'm glad we're talking. Me too. She takes a deep, shuddering breath. There's more I should tell you. Not about Sarah, but about... Oh, hell. I have to go, Ellery. I'm sorry. Please be careful there. And I'll call again when I can. Then she's gone. I drop the phone from my ear and get to my feet as Ezra strides toward me, looking ready to burst. What's going on? I heard some of it, but... Movement over his shoulder catches my eye, and I put a hand on his arm. Hang on. I have a lot to tell you, but there's somebody I want to talk to first. I wipe my eyes and glance at my phone. We're already late for work, but oh well. An older woman is manning the shooting gallery where Brooke used to work, yawning as she makes change and pulls levers. Vance Puckett stands with a toy gun mounted on his shoulder, methodically knocking over targets. Malcolm told us at lunch that he was interrogated again last night by Officer McNulty, who said the police interviewed Vance about his conversation with Brooke downtown. According to Vance, Brooke just asked him what time it was. Malcolm was frustrated, but Mia threw up her hands in resignation. Of course. Why should he help out? There's nothing in it for him, and he doesn't care about anybody in this town. Maybe she's right. Or maybe he's just broken in his own way. Vance fishes in his pockets for change to play another round. I sidle past a trio of preteens and plunk $2 on the counter. My treat this time, I say. He turns and squints, tapping his forefinger to his chin. It takes a few seconds for him to recognize me. Shooter girl! You got lucky that last game. Maybe, I say. I have $6 on me. Should we play best 2 out of 3? He nods, and I gesture toward the targets. Champions first.
Vance gets off to a shaky start, only hitting 8 out of 12 targets. It kills my competitive spirit to miss 5 when it's my turn, but all this will be pointless if he stalks off in a huff again when we're done.
You lost your touch, Vance smirks when I lower my gun.
Ezra, who's watching us with his hands on his hips, looks like he's physically biting his tongue.
I was just warming up, I lie. I keep it close in the next couple of rounds, losing by 1 each time. Vance is pumped up by the end, preening and chuckling, going so far as to slap me on the back when I miss my final shot.
Nice try, kid. You almost pulled one out.
I guess I did get lucky last time, I say with a theatrical sigh. I don't have Sadie's talent, which is obvious from Ezra's grimace, as we move to one side so the people waiting behind us can play. But I'm hoping it's good enough for a drunk guy.
My mother told me it probably wouldn't happen again. Vance adjusts his cap over oily hair.
Your mother?
Sadie Corcoran, I say. You're Vance, right? She said you guys went to homecoming together, and that I should introduce myself. I'm Ellery.
It's weird holding out my hand after what Sadie just told me, but he takes it, looking genuinely flummoxed.
She said that? Wouldn't have thought she even remembers me.
She talks about you all the time, I almost say, but decide to keep things believable.
She does. It's not easy for her to talk about Echo Ridge after what happened to her sister, but she's always spoken well of you.
It's close enough to true, I guess. And I'm feeling pretty charitable toward him myself, since he's the only person in Echo Ridge who has an alibi for both Sarah's and Brooke's disappearances. Suddenly, Vance Puckett is the most trustworthy man in town. He spits on the ground, close to my sneakers. Somehow I manage not to flinch.
Damn shame what happened.
I know. She's never gotten over it. And now my friend is missing. I glance at the new woman behind the counter.
I guess you knew Brooke, huh? Since you play here all the time?
Nice kid, he says gruffly.
He shuffles his feet, looking antsy and ready to move on. Ezra taps his watch and raises his brows at me. Get to the point.
The worst thing is, I know something was bothering her before she disappeared, I say. We were supposed to get together on Sunday so she could tell me what was going on, but we never got the chance. And it's killing me.
Tears spring into my eyes, still close to the surface from my conversation with Sadie, and spill down my cheeks. I'm playing a part, but Sadie's always said the best acting happens when you're emotionally connected to the scene. I'm torn up enough about what happened to Brooke to pull it off.
I wish I knew what she needed.
Vance rubs his jaw, rocks back on his heels, twists to look at the crowd over his shoulder.
I don't like getting involved, he mumbles. Not with people in this town, and especially not with the police.
Me either, I say quickly. We're total outsiders here. Brooke is one of my only friends.
I fish around in my bag for a Kleenex and blow my nose.
She asked me a strange question last week.
Vance speaks quietly in a rush, and my heart leaps into my throat.
Wanted to know how to pick a lock.
A shifty expression crosses his face.
Not sure why she'd think I'd know. I told her to Google it, or watch a YouTube video or something, or just use a couple of paper clips.
Paper clips? I ask. Vance swats at a hovering bug.
Those work sometimes, so I'm told. Anyway.
He meets my gaze,
and I see a glimmer of something like kindness in his bloodshot eyes.
That's a thing that was on her mind. So now you know.
Thanks, I say, feeling a pinprick of shame for manipulating him. You have no idea how much that helps.
Well, you tell your mother I said hello.
He tips his baseball cap and shuffles past Ezra, who brings his hands together in a slow clap once Vance is out of hearing range.
Well played, El. Although that guy's never gonna let you live down the loss.
I know, I sigh, digging for another Kleenex to dry my still damp cheeks. As I watch Vance melt into the crowd, a prickle of excitement works its way up my spine. Did you hear what he said, though? He told Brooke to pick a lock with paper clips.
Yeah, so?
So that's what she was holding in the House of Horror's office, remember? A straightened paperclip. I took it from her. She said something like, "This is harder than he said it would be." My voice climbs with anticipation, and I force it back down. She was trying to pick a lock right then and there, and we interrupted her.
The desk, maybe? Ezra wonders.
I shake my head. I get stuff out of that desk all the time. It isn't locked. But, heat floods my face as I remember where Brooke was sitting. But I think I know what is.
Chapter 23. Malcolm. Thursday, October 3rd. By Thursday, search parties for Brooke aren't limited to school hours anymore. There's one this afternoon covering the woods behind the Nilsons' house. Peter's a volunteer captain, and when I get home from band practice, he's loading a cardboard box filled with flyers, bottled water, and flashlights into the back of his Range Rover. Hello, Malcolm. He doesn't look at me as I get out of Mom's Volvo, just brushes his palms together as though they're dusty. I'm sure they aren't. Peter's car is as pristine as everything else the Nilsons own.
How was school?
Same. In other words, not good. When are we leaving? Peter crosses his arms, displaying razor-sharp creases in the shelves of his shirt.
We are leaving in 10 minutes, he says.
The emphasis is clear, but when I don't respond, he adds,
I don't think it's a good idea for you to come, Malcolm.
My heart sinks.
Why?
It's a pointless question. I know why. Officer McNulty has been back twice already to ask me follow-up questions. Peter's nostrils flare.
Emotions are running high right now. You'd be a distraction. I'm sorry, I know that's hard to hear, but it's the truth. And our first priority is finding Brooke.
My temper spikes.
I know. I want to help. The best way you can help is to stay here, Peter says, and my palms itch with an almost irresistible desire to punch the smug look off his face. I'm sure he's genuinely concerned, and he might even be right, but he gets off on being the hero too, always has. He claps a hand on my shoulder quickly, like he's killing a bug.
Why don't you go inside and see if there's any more water in the fridge? That would be helpful. A vein above my eye starts to throb.
Sure, I say, swallowing my anger because getting into a pissing match with Peter isn't going to help Brooke. When I get inside, I hear the staircase in the foyer creak. I'm hoping for my mother, but it's Katrin with a heap of red fabric hanging over her arm, followed by Viv. Katrin freezes when she sees me, and Viv almost bumps into her. Both of their faces harden into the mask of dislike I've been seeing everywhere since Sunday. I make an effort to act like I normally would.
What's that? I ask, gesturing toward Katrin's arm.
My homecoming dress, she snaps.
I eye the dress with a feeling of mild dread. I've been trying to block out the fact that homecoming is Saturday.
It's weird they're still having that,
Katrin doesn't reply, and I add, "What are you doing with your dress?"
"Your mom's going to have it pressed."
She gives me a wide berth as she makes her way into the kitchen, carefully draping the dress over the back of a chair. It's nice, I guess, that my mom does stuff like that for Katrin. Peter says Katrin's own mother hasn't responded to any of his calls all week, other than to text something about bad cell reception in the south of France. There's always some excuse. When she's finished arranging the dress, Katrin stares at me with glacial blue eyes.
"I'd better not see you there."
Somehow, Katrin doesn't make me angry like Peter does. Maybe because I know she's barely eaten or slept since Brooke went missing. Her cheeks are hollow, her lips chapped, her hair in a messy ponytail. "Katrin, come on," I say, my palms spread wide, the universal gesture of a guy who has nothing to hide. "Can we talk about this? What have I ever done to make you think I'd be capable of hurting Brooke?" She presses her lips together, nostrils flaring slightly. For a second, she looks exactly like Peter.
"You were involved with her and you didn't tell anyone."
"Jesus." I rake a hand through my hair, feeling a tug in my chest.
"Why do you keep saying that? Because you lost track of her during a sleepover? She was probably in the bathroom."
Katrin and I were never friends exactly, but I thought she knew me better than this.
"My room has a bathroom," Katrin points out. "She wasn't there."
"So she went for a walk.
She's afraid of the dark."
I give up. She's latched onto this for some reason, and there's no talking her out of it. I guess whatever bond I thought we had was just in my head, or something that amused her when she had nothing better to do. "Your dad's getting ready to leave," I say instead.
"I know, I need a phone charger. Wait here, Viv,"
she instructs. She stalks down the hallway leading to the study, leaving Viv and me to eye one another warily. I half expect her to follow Katrin, but she's a good minion. She stays put. "Still writing that article?" I ask. Viv flushes.
"No, I'm much too upset about Brooke to even think about that."
Her eyes are dry, though. Have been all week.
"Anyway, I already told the media what I think, so as far as I'm concerned, it's done."
"Good," I say. I turn away from her and open the double doors of the refrigerator. There are 2 6-packs of bottled water on the middle shelf, and I tuck them under my arm before heading outside. The back of Peter's Range Rover is still open. I push aside a cardboard box and drop the water beside it. The flash of a familiar face catches my eye, and I pull out a flyer from the box. Brooke's class picture is plastered next to the word "missing," her hair tumbling loose around her shoulders, and her smile bright. It startles me, because I can't remember the last time I saw Brooke looking that happy. I scan the rest of the flyer. Name, Brooke Adrian Bennett. Age, 17. Eyes, hazel. Hair, brown. Height, 5 feet 4 inches. Weight, 110 pounds. Last seen wearing, olive blazer, white t-shirt, black jeans, leopard print flats. Somebody else must have told them that last part. I was no help when Officer McNulty asked me to describe Brooke's clothes. "She looked nice," I said.
"I think that's everything."
Peter's voice startles me, and I drop the flyer back into the box. He opens the driver's side door and glances at his watch with a small frown.
"Could you ask Katrin and Viv to come to the car, please?"
"Okay." My phone buzzes as I head back inside, and when I get into the kitchen, I pull it out to a series of texts from Mia.
"Hey, you should come over. This just popped up online, and it's already everywhere."
The last message links to a Burlington Free Press article titled "A Tragic Past and a Common Thread." My stomach drops as I start to read. Echo Ridge is reeling. This picturesque town, nestled near the Canadian border and boasting the highest per capita income in the county, experienced its first tragic loss in 1996 when high school senior Sarah Corcoran vanished while walking home from the library. Then, 5 years ago, homecoming queen Lacey Kilduff was found dead in the aptly named, and since renamed, Murderland Halloween Park. Now another beautiful and popular teenager, 17-year-old Brooke Bennett, is missing. Though Brooke and Lacey are close in age, there seems to be little connection between the two young women, except an odd coincidence. The high school senior who dropped Bennett off at home the night she disappeared is the younger brother of Lacey Kilduff's former boyfriend, Declan Kelly. Kelly, who is questioned repeatedly after Lacey Kilduff's death but never arrested, moved out of state 4 years ago and has maintained a low profile since. So it came as a surprise to many in this close-knit community that Kelly relocated to the neighboring town of Salisbury shortly before Brooke Bennett's disappearance. Shit. Viv might not be writing any more articles, but someone else sure is. Suddenly, Peter looks like a genius. If I weren't going to cause drama during the search for Brooke before, I sure as hell would now. Katrin enters the kitchen, gripping her phone. Her cheeks are bright red, and I brace myself for another tirade. She probably just read the same article. Peter wants you guys outside, I say, hoping to cut off whatever lecture she has planned. She nods mechanically without speaking, looking first at Viv and then at me. Her face is weirdly immobile, like she's wearing a Katrin mask. Her hands shake as she shoves her phone into her pocket. He's not letting me come, I add. He says I'll be a distraction. I'm testing her, waiting for the expected, "Well, you would be," or "Distraction doesn't cover it, asshole." But all she says is, "Okay." She swallows hard, once, then twice. "Okay," she repeats, like she's trying to convince herself of something. She meets my eyes and looks down quickly, but not before I catch how huge her pupils are. She doesn't look mad anymore. She looks afraid. Chapter 24. Malcolm. Thursday, October 3rd. I get to Mia's house half an hour later, and I hear shouting as soon as I step onto the driveway. It's too early for her parents to be home, and anyway, they're not yellers. Mia is the only Kwan who ever raises her voice, but it's not her making all that noise. Nobody answers the doorbell, so I push the door open and step into the Kwan's living room. The first thing I see is Ellery sitting cross-legged in an armchair, her eyes wide as she surveys the scene in front of us. Mia stands barefoot next to the fireplace, hands on her hips, looking defiant but tiny without the height her boots give her. Daisy is across from her, a candlestick gripped in one hand, and an expression of pure rage distorting her usually serene features. "I'm going to kill you!" Daisy shrieks, drawing her arm back threateningly. "Stop being so dramatic," Mia says, but her eyes don't leave the candlestick. "What the hell?" I ask, and they both turn toward me. Daisy's furious expression briefly recedes, then comes roaring back like a tidal wave. "Oh, him too? You've got the entire Scooby gang here while you lay this bullshit on me?" I blink. I've never heard Daisy swear before. "What bullshit?" Mia speaks before Daisy can. "I told her I know all about Declan, and I'm going to tell Mom and Dad if she doesn't explain why they're both back in Echo Ridge. She takes an involuntary step back as Daisy fastens her with a withering stare.
It's going a little worse than I expected. You have some nerve!
Daisy brandishes the candlestick for emphasis, but stops in slack-jawed horror when she loses her grip and sends it flying directly